I will do my best to get through this, but if I can't, then I'll just have Jamie come up, I guess. Oh, no, we can't do that. We're a Baptist church. My fault. Well, yeah. That's true. That's true. Well, it seems like other denominations are letting it go, so. Okay, so took last week off. Did we read the Declaration of Independence in Sunday school? So I guess before I get started, everybody have the notes for today? Mr. Halat. This is Independence Hall in Philadelphia. So if you just raise your hand and Mr. Halat will come by and get you a sheet if you didn't get one. So 2 weeks ago we talked about I can get my slides to advance. 2 weeks ago we talked about the legality of the revolution. Okay. There we go. Legality of the revolution. And we went through some of the illegal things, especially in the minds of the colonists, that the king was doing. And then last week, on the 4th of July, we had the Declaration of Independence read. And how many of you, for the first time in your life, were able to identify historically all of the things that Thomas Jefferson wrote about? Don't have to raise your hands. But how applicable is that? Because you read through the Declaration of Independence and you go, okay, well, we understand that Thomas Jefferson and the signers of the Declaration are complaining about all these things, but now we can actually say, based on primary sources and based on a historical study of the Revolution, that, in fact, those things were taking place. And a lot of times, historians look at the Declaration of Independence as a piece of propaganda. Now, don't let the terminology propaganda just carry a completely negative connotation, because it doesn't always do that. Thomas Paine's pamphlet, Common Sense, was propaganda. Uncle Sam wanting you to join the U.S. Army during World War II is propaganda, but it's serving a positive purpose. But historians sometimes even look at the Declaration of Independence as negative propaganda. Thomas Jefferson just kind of made a bunch of stuff up, or partially made it up, and made it sound like the king was doing a lot worse things than he actually was. But through our study 2 weeks ago, we saw that a lot of that was taking place. You did have an illegal seizure of weapons from the Minutemen at Lexington in the town of Concord. You did have soldiers who were forced upon people. They had to quarter them. You did have the question of the legality of taxation through Parliament without any representation of the colonists. All of that is legally questionable. And Thomas Jefferson outlined all of those things. We talked about the Vice Admiralty Courts. And Jefferson specifically talks about those, saying that people are tried in essentially military courts and not allowed a jury of their peers to cast judgment on them. So I hope that was something that was a continuation of what we talked about those 2 weeks ago. Quickly, I wanted to talk about something that's not necessarily off topic, but something that I've been thinking about quite a bit over the course of the past week. So a lot of you know that I mow up in the town of Eaton during the summer. That affords me a lot of time to think, because usually have hearing protection in and you're just kind of alone with your thoughts as long as you can keep your line straight. And one thing that I was thinking about was what Pastor talked about before I started my series, and that was critical race theory and some of the articles that he was reading. And based on what he read and the studies that I've done and the lessons that I've taught on Karl Marx and the books that he wrote and what I know about the Russian Revolution and other communist revolutions, I am beginning to, and I don't want to overstate this to make it sound more, pressing than it actually is, I am becoming more and more convinced that we are seeing an actual communist revolution taking place in the United States. And the reason for that is that Karl Marx advocated for a revolution, in some cases a violent revolution, to rise up and overthrow what he considered the privileged bourgeoisie. And that was the label that he used. So it's class warfare. And Pastor read articles a couple, at this point, months ago, about how these classes are now being reclassified as races and other labels that can be put onto people. So we're not being, because in the United States, we don't have those classes. And we have a incredible ability to be mobile within those classes. Something that people who are socialists don't understand about capitalism is you can point your finger at all the people that are at the top and that have a bunch of wealth, but there's new people achieving that all the time, and there's new people finding themselves in poverty all the time. You have a massive amount of mobility between lower class, middle class, and upper class at a rate that's never been seen in any other society in history, that people can jump classes like that. If Jeff Bezos makes a lot of poor investments, spends his money very irresponsibly, in a couple generations, or maybe even in one generation, surprisingly, all of his wealth might actually be gone, which is not something that's easy to comprehend. But when people are critical of the wealth in the United States, some of it is stable, sometimes through corrupt purposes. They actually can't lose their wealth because they've, you know, they have insider trading information in the stock market or something like that. But for the most part, that wealth can be lost simply by making the wrong decisions, and it's really just one generation away from being completely spent and not being able to be possessed. So because we don't have the classes that Karl Marx says is a necessity for a communist revolution to take place, they're reclassifying everyone into other labels. And so now what needs to be overthrown in the United States according to democratic socialists? I'm looking for an answer. It's not rhetorical. Yeah, white supremacy. And where can you find white supremacy according to them? Anywhere you want to. Anywhere. I forget who I was talking to, I was talking to one of my coaching friends, and he was reading up on the critical race theory, and he said the one thing, because he wanted to be educated on it, because we're both teachers at Central, he said the one thing that I think can surmise the entire situation is that there is racism. White people are racist, but you have to trust me when I tell you that. And I'm not going to provide you any actual information. So if white males, white Christian males, and white people in general need to be overthrown, who's going to do the overthrowing? Who is the proletariat, quote unquote? Because to Karl Marx, that's the working class. But the working class is overwhelmingly conservative in the United States. So the working class isn't going to overthrow the wealthy. They actually are the creators of the wealth. And they benefit from that. So the proletariat to the modern democratic socialists, in my mind, is those people of oppressed groups. LGBTQ, I saw like the full acronym that they finally landed on. Man, you need 4 pages just to fill. Like, I don't even know how all those people feel about being thrown into the same group, but it's pretty incredible. Yes?
Just a question for clarification. Mm-hmm. You're saying
Two main classes, the bourgeoisie, which are the wealthy, and the proletariat, which are the workers.
And now since we have a very fluid, and that does not exist in today's society, the communist movement, the Marxist movement, is substituting that and replacing it with racism.
Correct.
It's clear.
Correct. Because who is the privileged bourgeoisie? White people. And what benefits them? Our current government, which is not communist, which in their mind needs to be overthrown. So how do you overthrow it? By saying its entire founding was racist, it's wrong, it's gotta be, the American flag is now racist, and everything is racist, and that's the new buzzword that's going to usher in socialism, because Black Lives Matter, socialist organization. And that's not me and Pastor putting that label on them. They're self-proclaimed. It says it right on their website. So if they're socialist and they're advocating so strongly for this racial inequality that anyone with actual eyesight into society has a very tough time finding, what is the end goal? It's revolution. It is. And that's, I'm still kind of working through that, but I felt like it was applicable to what's going on here, because I don't know what type of presence, what type of violent presence is going to be in Greeley, Colorado in the next 5 years. I don't know. And what is our legal responsibility? That's a major question, and actually the purpose of what we're talking about. Do we have legal standing to even stage another overthrow of a government? And that sounds so extreme to talk about. Many of you probably never even thought it would ever happen back in the 1970s and 80s that you'd even think about having to run into issues like this. But I think we might have to at least talk about it in the near future. Yes, do you have a comment?
Talking about the fact that this, they are the revolutionaries, what does that make us? The counter-revolutionaries.
Correct.
If we have to stand up soon and say, no, this is not going to happen here, although they call us the insurrectionists, they call us the revolutionaries, we are not. We are trying to conserve what we have, conservatives. We are the counter-revolutionaries, and I think that needs to be pointed out, even as it has been pointed out by a number of people. We are not revolutionaries now.
No, and if you go to the south side of Chicago and you're a part of the Chicago PD, who is instigating the violence? The cops who are returning fire in a shootout, or the people shooting at the cops? Because what we're doing as a society is blaming the policemen and not the people that are breaking the law. Policemen aren't doing anything wrong. Policemen are the enforcement of the law, which is legal. The people breaking the law are the lawbreakers, and I think that's the difference between a situation that we might find ourselves in. Socialism is not the legal law of the United States. Now, if it does legally become law through the processes of the Congress, then I think that's a different discussion. But if it's an illegal seizure, this is why the election of 2020 is such a huge deal, and why all of those votes needed to be investigated, regardless of whether you're Democrat or Republican. Because if Joe Biden is not the actual legal president of the United States, he has no executive power. And we are currently without an executive. That's a huge deal. But instead, we said, well, we're not going to investigate it because there's no evidence. Well, you investigate to find evidence because there's a probable cause of investigation. So, yes. Okay. And that is still, that has not been, okay.
It's illegal for communism to be here in the States. And if you're a communist, you can go to jail and lose your citizenship.
Interesting. Which is communism that you vote for because it's democratic. Oh, interesting. Okay, I'm going to have to look up that. I did not know that there was a law. It makes sense that it was 1954 because that was probably the height of the McCarthy era of... Yeah, that would be... Yeah, and the issue with that is the enforcement of that law falls in the executive, and right now there's no way that the executive would enforce an anti-communism. Yeah, Congress could probably bring it up to the floor and update it and make it more current. So Something to, yeah, that's interesting.
That's something I believe in, because number one, I love God, I love my country, I fought for my country, and
absolutely.
What I'm doing is not good.
No, no.
I watched, I did some research on a gentleman running for Congress, and I have, there's a gentleman in Utah running for Congress that's an ex-soldier. He was wounded and medically retired by the Army. 80% of his body was burned. And because he did a celebration salute in his uniform, he was censored.
Absolutely.
He's running for Senate.
Okay.
So I wish him a lot of luck.
Yeah, and that would be something else probably for us to to look into as well. I mean, along with that act of communism. So. Yeah. So anyway, that was I guess a little bit off topic since we're talking about the revolution in the 1770s. But we're going to talk about the results of the American Revolution. 2 weeks ago, I said that we were going to go through the actual revolution and talk about the battles and soldiers, but I got to thinking about that, and I don't think that that will actually help the actual purpose of our research. That's going to be mostly just historical fact, and we could list all the battles and all the historical figures that were a part of them, but I don't think that it would lend itself to a conversation about whether or not it was legal. So if you want to look up that stuff just to get kind of a context, that would be great. That's not going to be something that we'll look at in this series. So today we're going to study the results of the American Revolution and this idea of the end justifying the means in a historical setting. Now, is there anybody here that would say that the saying, the ends justify the means, is a good saying? It's right to say that. That essentially whatever the results are, that's what's important, as opposed to the way that you get those results. Yes and no, right? Most of the time we would say no, because I think that's a conversation for liberal Christianity too, right? Well, look at all the people who are making professions of salvation. The means, the way by which we get those professions of salvation, is not really important. The fact is that we're getting them. Is that true? No, that's not how God told us to reach souls, and so you can't say the ends justify the means in that situation. In a historical setting, historians a lot of times have to look at the ends and then try to understand the means. A great example of this is Napoleon. The end of Napoleon's era resulted in nationalism spreading throughout Europe. Nationalism resulted in the overthrow of a lot of monarchies and representative government for localities throughout Europe. Is that a good thing? Absolutely. And there's a lot of other things that Napoleon did in his reign over the European continent for those years that were actually really good, like expanding the amount of people who could own land, the beginnings of universal manhood suffrage, the right of every person to have a say in their government. Those are all good things. But what were the means by which Napoleon accomplished those, and what were his purposes in accomplishing those? He was a warmonger. He wanted glory for himself. He crowned himself Emperor of France, taking the crown from the Pope and crowning himself. He was very egotistical. It was success for Napoleon. So all of that in a study of Napoleon is important because the ends seem like they're good. So is Napoleon a good figure in history or a bad figure in history? Those labels are very, very hard to put on historical figures. But I still think that the question of what is the end of the American Revolution is still applicable to whether or not it was actually legal. Because next week what we're going to look at is the French Revolution. In the process, the means by which the French have their revolution is, in my opinion, illegal, but the results are catastrophic. the results in the United States are overwhelmingly positive. So I think that that reflects whether or not the American Revolution was legal, and that's why I have this saying up there. So let's talk about the Treaty of Paris, so 1781. So you have 6 years of the American Revolution, 1775 is Lexington and Concord, and then the Treaty of Paris ends it in 1781. So this does three things. First of all, it recognizes the colony as a sovereign state. Or, in this case, and we'll talk about the Articles of Confederation on the next slide, a sovereign confederacy of states. In the United States, and I might have mentioned this before, so I'll just kind of go through this quickly. In the United States, we think of states, the term state means province, and the word country means the entire conglomeration of it. That's incorrect. A state itself is a sovereign area that can govern itself. So the state of Colorado is in and of itself, in our terminology, a country. So the term United States of America is the United Countries of America in actuality. And I'm sure Pastor would love to apply this to the Civil War, because in discussing states' rights, this is extremely applicable. Because the idea of the North was more that we were one cohesive country, and the idea of the South is that, no, we're all a bunch of independent states that have agreed to put ourselves under the rule of the Constitution. And that's an argument for another day. But this is a confederacy of states, of independent. If you're from Virginia, you're a Virginian. You're an American because you live on the American continent, but you're from Virginia. So that's an important differentiation to make. It also allows for settlement in the Ohio River Valley in the Western Frontier. During this time, the Western Frontier is going to be like Kentucky. So don't think about it as the Wild West. There's no Dodge City Marshals running around during this time. But this is going to be very important for what happens in the War of 1812. You get 30 years into the future, and the English have not vacated their courts, their forts in the Western Frontier, and that leads to the War of 1812, partially. This is another result of the Treaty of Paris, and I'm trying to look at this as like a big picture. If you fast forward after the War of 1812, the relationship between England and the United States becomes closer and closer. And this is applicable because the United States does not want to exact revenge on England following the American Revolution, which again, in my mind, is a symbol of the legality of the American Revolution. They want freedom from England. They don't hold any grudges against the English after the war is over. They've accomplished what they wanted to, and now they understand the importance of pursuing, as I say here, foreign policies in the future that will eventually lead to a very close relationship and close alliance. And we see that playing out in World War I and World War II throughout the 19th century, that England and the United States become very close. So I think that is, and the first part I think is very important as well. The United States respects England very much because for so many years they viewed themselves as English and they respect the English tradition. Their complaint was that the actual English tradition of government was not being symbolized in the power of King George III and Parliament at the time. So in their mind, they're saying, Parliament and King George III specifically, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. So once that changes and England becomes the leader of the free world while the United States is a young country, there's a lot of respect there, and the United States is seeing that there's a lot of good coming out of England. And the American Revolution does change England. And that's best exemplified in the independence of Canada. As soon as there is rumors in Canada among the Canadians that they want independence from England and it's becoming violent, England immediately gives them autonomy. And this is how England has changed over the course of those years. As they see, we don't want another American Revolution happening in Canada, and we understand the importance of giving people a say in their own government. So the Treaty of Paris changes England over time in a very positive way, and they understand the importance of that, not that iron-fisted rule, which I think is also very important. Okay, let's talk about the Articles of Confederation. This is pre-Constitution. The Constitutional Convention opens in Philadelphia in 1787. So from 1781, from 1781 until 1789, when the Constitution is ratified, the United States is organized under the Articles of the Confederation. So very quickly, this is a result of the American Revolution, so it does apply here. Because what we're going to see is the Constitution, which is that great piece of civic history, it comes out of the failures of the Articles of Confederation. Articles of Confederation immediately draws our minds to the Confederate States of America. The Articles of Confederation are more closely aligned with what the Southern states would have supported. A loose confederation is very different than a United States of America. Confederate States of America, a confederacy is more like, we all agree kind of on the same stuff, so let's be on the same side. If you're united under the Constitution, now you all have to abide by this document, and there's an insinuation that there's a lot more buy-in to that. Okay? So Articles of Confederation does not allow the government to levy taxes for obvious reasons. We just got done with a revolution, which was based on, essentially, taxation. So they're not going to give their national government the power to levy taxes. That's going to be left up to the states. Well, that's a problem because now the national government doesn't have any funding. So they don't have a standing army. There's no security that's being afforded to the people of the United States on a national level. Let's just go back to those state militias, and that affords some problems because you're going to have big states like Virginia, and what's going to keep a big state like Virginia from taking advantage of a small state like Maryland? There's really not a lot in the way because the National Congress at the time doesn't have the power to enforce anything. And that's going to be the last point there. But thirdly, it doesn't have the authority to mint any national currency. So from New England down to Georgia, all of those states now, previously colonies, all of those states are printing their own currency. How does interstate commerce then be carried out in any sort of organized way? Who's to decide whether South Carolina's currency can translate to Georgia's currency? And who gets to set the rate of that? Because Georgia isn't going to want to devalue its currency to South Carolina's, and South Carolina won't want to devalue its currency. So the South Carolina dollar wants to be really, really high, but so does the Georgia dollar. And what if the person doing business says, well, I'm not going to accept Georgian currency because I don't know how much it's actually worth in South Carolina? And so you have this whole mess of disagreement about who's going to have the authority to mint money. But then the overarching issue with the Articles of Confederation is there is no executive office. There is basically just the position that John Hancock fills as a president of the Congress. But there's only a legislative branch under the Articles of Confederation. There is a judicial part to the Articles of Confederation that I'm not really familiar with, but there is no executive. Once again, that is because of the bad taste that the colonists have in their mouth over King George. We don't want to give a single person power. Well, that kind of goes all the way back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this series with absolute monarchy. Absolute monarchy is great if you have one person, a super good person, and they can make all the decisions because it's really, really easy. If Pastor Unruh was completely infallible and could make all the right decisions for this church, wouldn't it be great if we were like, oh, you just make all the decisions. We don't have to vote. No more business meetings. We don't have to vote on what we do with any property, any building that we do. Just make all the decisions. We totally trust you with everything. It's super efficient. He's just going to sit in his office. He's going to dictate everything that the church needs to do. But what happens if the next pastor is not as good at making decisions? Well, now he has all the powers and he's making all the wrong decisions. Okay, so there is something to be said for a person who's in charge you almost always have to have that. You have to have some sort of executive where the buck is going to stop. The other thing is there's something about the image of a head of state. And for the longest time, I did not understand why England still has the monarchy. I'm American, so I'm very pragmatic when it comes to government. Why in the world would you have someone who's the Queen of England who has no power? Then I was listening to a podcast where someone from England was explaining it and saying, this is actually a very good thing because it's more about the image of the monarch as they are the state. They are the country, and they're the embodiment of the country. And when you have the premier, like the prime minister, who in a parliamentary government is essentially the president, bow before the queen, he is showing his obeisance to the country. And we don't have that in the United States. President Biden does not appear, he is the head of state. So in that embodiment, he does not appear to have any sort of obeisance or any sort of respect, imagery-wise, to anything. Right? Maybe when the national anthem is played, maybe when he says the Pledge of Allegiance, you could say that's kind of that image. But think about how profound it would be if you had an Uncle Sam type figure that Joe Biden had to show that he was beneath. I think that would go a long ways. And I finally understood why the English keep their monarch, because of that image. And it's not a worthless image. And if you can think about pictures of presidents praying, how powerful is that? One of the most powerful men in the entire world showing that he is beneath someone, that there is a higher power than him. Because a lot of times you do not get that imagery. And people think, oh, the president has all the power in the United States. That's not the case, but it appears to be the case. So there's other things about this executive office that are important that the Articles of Confederation just simply don't provide for. And you have states basically running amok and taking advantage of other states because there's no power to enforce any laws of equality among small states, big states, etc. Federalism is a result of the American Revolution. And federalism is probably one of the greatest governmental ideas in history, like ever. And this is the idea of a layered government, a government whose power is spread out among a lot of different entities. So you have three main levels of government, in my mind anyway, and this is not like, I don't want to say gospel because that seems irreverent, but this is not, like, this is Brandon Unruh's idea of federalism, okay? This isn't everyone's idea of it. So in my mind, there's three main levels of government. There's the local, and this would be like town government, the mayor, city council, etc. You have the state government, and under local, I would include county government, okay, so county commissioners. You have state government, of course, that's the state Congress, in some cases bicameral, in Nebraska's case, and I think there's one other state, unicameral, there's only one house. And then the federal or the national government. So the power of the government is layered, and that's outlined in the Constitution, where you have enumerated rights and unenumerated rights. The enumerated rights, for the most part, are the rights, or the powers, enumerated powers, I should say, not rights. But enumerated powers are those that are specifically given to the federal government. And for the most part, unenumerated power, sometimes they're implied powers, but we're getting into a lot of terminology. Unenumerated powers of government are usually left to these other two levels of government, the local government and the state government. So the Constitution even ends in kind of wrapping everything up and saying any powers not specifically given to the federal government are given back to the states and then to the people. So that's where I get my three levels. Any powers not given to the federal government are given to the states and to the people, being us specifically, but also our local governments, which serves us the most directly. So this is invented by the founders with the following ideas. That government should be uncentralized, or decentralized might be the better word there. As I was typing it, I was like, is that a word, uncentralized? But I didn't think of decentralized at the time. But it didn't give me the squiggly red lines. If you write it down in your notes, I think you'll still sound somewhat intelligent if you're showing it to someone. So government should be decentralized, uncentralized. They don't want all the power to rest in one area. I was talking to my brother-in-law several years ago, Keaton Summers, who lives out in Illinois. He had this fantastic idea about what to do with all of the offices, all of those alphabet soup organizations under the executive office. So we have a Department of Agriculture that's based where? In Washington, D.C. Why in the world would you make the Department of Agriculture so far away from where all of the agriculture takes place? That made sense back in the 1700s or the early 1800s when Washington, D.C. was built as a capital, but it doesn't make sense today. So he goes, all of those executive offices should be translated, should be moved to the places where they're the most central for the people who use them. Imagine if the Department of Agriculture was based in Kansas City, Missouri. Wouldn't there be way more pressure on the Department of Agriculture to actually serve the needs of the people on behalf of agriculture? I thought that's a fantastic idea. That's the idea that the founders have. Essentially, is that you should spread the powers of the government out so that they can't become too centralized and you don't have this power that's resting in one area and all the power that's resting in this one person. And what do we have today? All the power is resting in Washington, D.C. And through appearance and through actual fact, a lot of the power is now resting upon one person, the president. And that was never intended by the founders. The other idea is that the most efficient government is going to be the smallest and most local government. Who understands best the needs of the people in Weld County? The Weld County Commissioner or the President of the United States? And we're talking specifically about Weld County. Obviously, the County Commissioner does because he lives here. He's probably from Weld County. He talks with people from Weld County every day. He sees people. He sees the actual physical county and what state it's in. He is a patron of the businesses in Weld County. It doesn't make any sense to give that power to the state governor. I don't even know, has Jared Polis even visited Greeley? Has he? How many times since he took office, do you know? Not many for the city that's funding everything that he does, huh? But it wouldn't make very much sense to give the power of the county commissioner to the governor of Colorado, even if he was a great governor, because he's not in Weld County. Right? So the most efficient government is the one that's the most accessible to the people. School boards, city councils. We can actually attend those. It's going to be very laborious for us to go to attend a session of Congress in Washington, D.C., and to directly hold those people accountable by our attendance. So we don't want them to have as much power over our personal lives. Okay? And that's a critical idea within federalism. The Bill of Rights, this is another result of the American Revolution. The Bill of Rights is going to outline rights that cannot be taken away by the federal government or any government, local or state, or any entity, a business, or any person. In your notes there, under number 4, I just have federal government, but I added this because it is important, and the Supreme Court rules on things like this all the time. If a business violates your rights that are outlined in the Bill of Rights, that's a problem. And the Supreme Court will rule on actions that need to be taken so that your rights are protected not just from the government, but from anything that can infringe upon them. The Bill of Rights is included in the Constitution upon the insistence of anti-federalists. The term back then made a lot of sense to people, but since we don't understand as much, well, you know what federalism is now, but we don't have those political parties anymore, they're probably more accurately labeled today as anti-constitutionalists. And that makes them sound really bad. But what they were, essentially, is people that were worried about the Constitution setting up any sort of centralized government. They were in favor of getting rid of the Articles of Confederation, but they weren't really hot on a lot of the powers that were going to be given to the executive, the President of the United States. So they're anti-federalists, they're against the ratification of the Constitution, but the compromise, this fantastic compromise in American history, is that James Madison supports the inclusion in the end of a Bill of Rights. And he says, this is dumb. We don't need to include a Bill of Rights because all of this stuff is implied. Well, how thankful are we that the anti-federalists were like, they're not implied and they need to be written in the Constitution. If you talk to people from England, they are in a bad way right now, especially if you live in any sort of city there. Your right of privacy is gone. Your freedom of speech is gone. And they, conservatives in England, directly point to the fact that they don't have a Bill of Rights. There's nothing preventing the government from changing that. When I was listening to a radio show and somebody from England, a conservative from England, was pointing that out, I had never actually thought of that before, believe it or not. That if you're British, you don't have a Bill of Rights. There's no place where your rights as a citizen are enumerated. They have a constitution. They have a constitutional monarchy, sort of. But that's got to be terrifying. In the United States, we say, well, I have freedom of speech. And that's protected through rulings by federal courts and laws and all these things, and you can't infringe upon that. But the British people in Britain today must be, I think we're gonna see an influx of immigrants from Europe again to the United States, because it is becoming highly oppressive there. Those governments, especially with COVID, Germany is, I don't even know if they're certainly not borderline socialist anymore, but I think they're borderline communist at this point. And it's got to be terrifying for those people to live under that. Yes? Yes. Madison and Hamilton were Federalists. George Washington was a Federalist. Ben Franklin was a Federalist. Thomas Jefferson was more of an anti-Federalist.
Mm-hmm. With a sound constitution, that a Bill of Rights was not only not necessary, but also could be a dangerous instrument, a legal instrument to have in there. And I'm just throwing that out to you.
I think overwhelmingly it has been a positive result to have the Bill of Rights. Because if you think about the direction that we're going over the 8 years of the Obama administration, the respite we had with 4 years under Trump, and now the first year of Biden's administration, you can quickly see if there was no Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, or the idea of the First Amendment, would be severely limited. We'd be seeing all of the hate speech laws that are being passed in Europe would be passed here. Your right to own firearms would have been gone probably 15, 20 years ago. And the only thing standing in the way is the fact that the Bill of Rights is legal writing. It's black and white, essentially. And when the Supreme Court judges on that, we actually do still have a very good Supreme Court. They have no choice. It's right there. It's right there. You can't infringe upon the right to own weapons. You can't infringe upon freedom of speech. And when they rule, unless they want a violent uprising of people that say, no, it's actually right there, they have to at least take that into account. And so it slows down this progression of liberalism. And just, that's a great point, though, or a great question. And just kind of in closing, we'll get to the rest of everything, the principles of government, next week before we talk about the French Revolution. Now I forgot what I was going to say. Must not have been that important. No, it's not your fault. It's gone. Yep. Getting old. I'm turning 30 next month, so you know how it is. No, I will. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to probably think about it on the drive home, and then I will. I'll talk about it next week. But this is a good place to stop because we're running out of time, and I'm looking forward to next week, and then the week after that is going to be mostly discussion. So write questions down. A lot of times there's blank areas at the bottom. I want to have discussion time because a lot of this has been very me talking to you, and I want to have discussions in a group setting. I think it's going to be extremely beneficial, and we're going to have some great points that are brought up. And then August 1st, right? Is it the 1st? Pastor will begin his series on the biblical justification, if it's biblically justified. We got to have that suspense to keep you guys coming back. It's like the TV show that ends on a cliffhanger. It's coming back. So let's pray, and then we'll be dismissed.